My name is Susanna Holsey. I'm having great pleasure of welcoming you on the behalf of the SVU New York, which is the Czechoslovak Society of Arts and Sciences, a 50-year-old organization, which is going through now some facelift. And our organization mission is to promote the cultural heritage and intellectual history of Czechs and Slovaks and promote it really with our American societies. Tonight we have a great opportunity to learn about literary translation, and we will learn from the best of the best. But before I go any further, I need to thank two main partners in crime, and that's the Czech Center, and namely Pavla Niklova, the director, and her team, her terrific team. Also the Bohemian Benevolent and Literary Association, neboli BBLA. BBLA is a 100-year-old organization, and it's our actually provider, and that's why we can do these events free of charge. And last but not least, I need to thank two people who helped with this project, and that's Kateřina Kyselica over there. Where is he? Zdeněk Fučík, behind camera. In Prague, it's Viktor Debnar from the Czech Literature Portal, and my friend in Paris, Jiří Eichler. Without him, we would have no Facebook and website, I guess. And all of you who actually helped and volunteered and gave your talent and skills and expertise. I talked about the music, so again, I want to remind you that the music you heard before was from those two LPs, jazz, Československý jazz 1965 and 64, and in the future we'll have a program talking with the musicians who actually, at least five of them, emigrated to the U.S. and live and play here. So, okay, without any further ado, I would like to give you my colleague Chris Harwood. Chris teaches Czech literature and Czech language and anything Czech at Columbia University. He just finished a three-day Czech studies workshop. You might have also admired his interpreting skills on many occasions, which I'm totally in awe. Chris Harwood.
Thank you. Well, it's an honor and really just a pleasure to be moderating this event, which is about Czech literature and Czech literature in English, which is what the environment I spend a lot of time in. So we're not here mostly to listen to me, but to these people who are really involved in the profession of bringing Czech literature to an English-speaking audience. So I'd like to briefly introduce each of them, and first of all to introduce in absentia the one great translator who was on the program but could not make it, and that's my mentor, Professor Peter Kusi, my predecessor as lecturer in Czech at Columbia University, and of course a great, great translator of Kundera, Grusha, and many other wonderful Czech authors, a guy who's done just tremendous service to Czech literature and the Czech language. Peter was just not feeling well enough today to make it to these events, which is a shame. However, we do have three of the other, I would say, most important people in North America for Czech literature. And so to introduce them briefly, give you my personal introduction. There's information on each of these people in your program, which I won't repeat. What these people mean to me. Paul Wilson, who gave the keynote address at our workshop on Friday, and who's a tremendous inspiration to me, both for the work he's done translating some of my favorite books, like I Served the King of England by Bohumil Hrabal, among others, but also giving this tremendous example that a North American, an English-speaking North American, could actually go into that strange environment and live in it and become part of it and become a legend within it. So I've gone and lived there. I haven't yet achieved the legendary status Paul has.
That's but
yeah, I figure I've got a few more, four more years to work on that. So Paul Wilson, please welcome. Rob Wexler, to whom I'm extremely grateful for the work he's done with Catbird Press, which has made available a huge percentage of the books that are on my syllabi. If they weren't there, I don't know exactly what I would teach. Again, a tremendous service that Rob's work has done to bring both contemporary and slightly older Czech literature to an English-speaking audience. And Rob has also done great work as a translator himself and has written a wonderful book on the art of translation that I highly recommend to you. So please welcome Rob Wexler. And finally, Alex Zucker, my fellow disciple of Peter Kusi, a man who has translated recent books from Czech, which were considered basically untranslatable. I'm just in awe of what Alex has done with some of the best and most demanding contemporary Czech authors, translating notably Joachim Topol's Sestra, a book which has left such a mark on me that my firstborn son's name is Joachim. So, Alex Zucker. So, the format of our program this evening is I get to hog the proceedings a little bit first and pose a few questions to our participants, and then after a while I will turn over the floor to you, because I'm sure that many of you have specific or general questions you would like to pose to our distinguished guests. So the first question I have that I would like each of our participants to respond to is about your beginnings as a translator from Czech into English. And so the first part of that question would be, at what point did you feel sufficiently confident in your literacy in Czech and in English to attempt to translate a work of Czech literature into English? So that would be the first part of the question. And the second part of the question was, what was the first work of Czech literature you translated, and what led you to that project? So, Paul?
Okay, this is it's a difficult question, because when I first I went to Czechoslovakia with no ambition whatsoever to become a translator. I don't think anyone actually has an ambition to be a translator. It's one of the things, it happens to you. It's not something you choose. But the very first night I was in Prague, and I'd barely been in the country for more than 12 hours, maybe 24 hours, I ran into a fellow who's still a friend of mine, of ours, who said he was very excited that I was coming to Prague to live for a year. This was 1967. And he pulled a book out of his shelf, and it was a book by a Czech philosopher that he was extremely fond of called Ladislav Klima, philosopher and novelist, very eccentric writer. And he said, you must translate this into English. I had no intention I wasn't even thinking at that point of learning Czech, let alone translating it. That's what everyone said. It was a rather odd request at that point. The question was, at what point did I begin to think about translating Czech literature into English? And I suppose it was at that point that the idea was planted in my mind. And this was day one of my 10-year sojourn in Czechoslovakia. The first work that I started translating quite soon after that, because as I began teaching English, one of my teaching jobs was to teach every Friday at the University of the 17th of November, as it was called then. I did not have African students. I had Czech students who were in a special translation department where they were learning how to translate at a kind of slightly higher level. So I immediately, or very soon after I began working with them, we began doing translations into English from Czech. And I surreptitiously used this as a way of learning Czech, because I would give them short texts by Joseph Skvoretsky, and I would have them, I think it was a cabaret style sort of literary evenings in Prague called Textapili. And there was, you know, Ivan Viskočil and Joseph Skvoretsky were two of the writers who contributed to this. And so we took some of these texts And I had them translate them for me into English. And then I corrected their English, but at the same time I was learning Czech. So part of the process of learning Czech was the process of translating Škvoretský and Vyskočil and then other writers into English. And the interesting thing is that there's this sort of style of publication called feuilleton in Czech, very short texts. And there were some Czech writers like Jan Skatzel from Brno, who were extremely adept at writing one-page texts, which were perfect for an hour because you could translate the whole text, the whole work in one lesson. So that was, I suppose, the first Czech literature that I, in collaboration with my students, translated, were these short texts by Czech writers. But the first like real job that I had was after I was expelled in 1977, and the first real work that I did was which I would consider serious work was Joseph Skvoretský's The Engineer of Human Souls, and we can talk about that later perhaps more, but I've said enough and I'll pass the baton.
Thank you, Paul. Rob.
Well, I have a sort of an odd situation in a lot of these because I'm not primarily a translator. I've done very little translation and only one book. So my answer is basically I've never been fluent in Czech. And the interesting thing about that is that I would argue that fluency is, though very important, is in some ways not necessary. The more literary a text is, the more important it is that you can understand the what the writer is doing and how the writer is doing it and be able to create that in English than it is to know what each word, you know, all the meanings of all the words. It really depends on the writer in terms of what, how much you need to know. And a lot of great, particularly with poetry, a lot of great translations have been done by people who aren't fluent in the language. And it's very inefficient way. I mean, nobody who's going to make a living or even do any serious amount of translation is, if they aren't fluent, it's going to take them forever. So it's very important for that. But I did the one novel I translated. I translated actually because Paul was supposed to translate it, and he just didn't have enough time.
You didn't have enough money.
And I didn't have enough money. I thought it was a pretty good offer. And I didn't have enough money to offset the time. Anyway, and so I loved the novel, and I decided to do it myself because it was so difficult that I figured that I could do it as well. And I also had the advantage, one, of working, having Peter Cusey as also my mentor, to ask questions of when I had problems. And the author's English was fairly good, and his daughter was a professional translator from English to Czech. So between them, I could ask lots of questions, and that really gave me the confidence to do it. But it was interesting because a lot of times I would read a sentence, you know, these long sentences that had to be taken apart and put back together, and I couldn't make – it was really difficult to understand what he was doing. And there was actually a German translation of the novel, which I had, and my German, you know, was okay, so I could check and see what they did. In almost every case where I found a sentence that was almost impossible, the sentence was not even translated in the Czech. They just skipped it completely, which is one thing very different about American and European translation. Most European translations are written by people who make a living doing it. Most American translations are not written by people who make a living. So they tend to actually put more time into it because they're not doing it. They're not trying to see if they can get six novels translated in 1 year. And this person who translated it clearly was in a rush and just didn't bother. But it was, I would ask Peter, and he couldn't make any sense of it. And I would make an attempt. In most cases, actually, the author said I'd gotten it right, so I was very happy. But it was hard. And the harder it is, in a certain sense, the less it matters how fluent you are. So.
Well, all right. Did you say what you actually translated?
Oh, it's Alexander Kliment's. I translate it as Living Parallel. It's actually
Nudav Čechák.
Yeah, Nudav Čechák. Boy, it's been so long. Yes, Nudav Čechák, which just doesn't work as a title in English very well. But that's a whole other issue we could talk about.
Yeah. All right, so Peter Cusey, yeah. So Peter Cusey was I always say he's my first Czech teacher, but actually he wasn't, because my interest in Czech actually began out of an interest in human rights in Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. So I went to the School of International Public Affairs at Columbia to study East Central Europe and Czechoslovakia as part of that. And I went to Columbia because it was one of two schools in the country that had a program that was that had international affairs with somebody who taught Czech, who was Peter Kusi, although he was not in the international affairs school. Columbia was the only school in the country that allowed you to study Eastern Europe that had a separate institute that wasn't everywhere else. It was Soviet and East European studies or Russian and East European studies. And Columbia had this institute on East Central Europe. So that, combined with the fact that there was somebody there who actually taught Czech, was the reason I applied to that school. And I think I got in because I had been to Czechoslovakia already, because I went there the first time in 87. And I started this grad school in 88. But now I got to take back what I just said, because the reason I went to Czechoslovakia the first time in 87 was because I had a girlfriend who gave me the Book of Laughter and Forgetting. So, but that was a book about politics as far as I was concerned. So that was my main interest in it. But I think the first day of Czech class, Kusi brought in a poem by Miroslav Holub. Yeah. And all I remember about it was I had something about looking through a microscope and a reference to, I think his name is Don Carlos Williams. Is that right, the American poet?
William Carlos.
William Carlos Williams. Thank you. And so we were essentially translating from day one. We were reading Czech from day one. We didn't know anything about Czech, but he walked us through it. So, and I think during my second year, he was translating Nesmrtelnost, Immortality, by Kundera, and he brought in pieces of that occasionally. So we got to see, you know, on the old printout computer with his erasures and everything in it. And so, you know, I also never planned to be a translator. I do think people now do plan to be there are MFAs in creative writing and translation that you can go to, and there, I mean, all these people at the American Literary Translators Association who say, I want to be a translator, and they go and they learn how. But Czech has a lot of people who translate who didn't go that route, and I think it's kind of interesting because the other thing that's probably not unique to the Czech Republic, but there are very, you know, writers there, they just start writing. They don't do an MFA in creative writing, so that maybe some there's some connection there. I don't know. I think that's interesting. So I don't know. So I started translating from the beginning in whatever exercises we did, but I think the first, and then the first paid translation I ever did was a one-sentence story for the Czechoslovak news agency. I was a translator. I moved to Prague in the fall of 1990, and I got this job with ČTK, and I was translating the Czech and Slovak wire service. And I think the first story they gave me was, today in the blah, blah, blah hall of Prague Castle, Czech and Slovak Federative Republic President Václav Havel received the new ambassador from Nigeria, blah, 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 blah. And I say that was my first paid translation because I hadn't been, you know, I was an employee of this company. But the first literary thing I did, I think, was it was a story called Patsy Patsy Patsyčky by a guy. It wasn't a children's story, though. It was by a guy. I think his pen name was Václav Baumann, but that wasn't his real name. And it was probably originally in Revolver Revy, when it was in Samizdat, but this was in fall of 1990, and I translated it for an English language literary magazine in Prague called Jazyk, which was spelled Y-A-Z-Z-Y-K. And so that was the first thing I did, I think. And the first book I did, I don't even want to talk about it, was a book called The Sex Collector.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was by a guy who, I mean, it's public, so I'm not going to hide it. So, but he was a Czech man who lived in Australia, and he made a life of traveling on around the world visiting brothels, and he wrote a book about it. And I don't remember how he found me, but I said, if you pay me this much, I'll do it. And I don't want my name on it. And I don't know if he ever found an English language publisher or not. And I did a book, a history about the Škoda factory and a history of the life of some modernist architect from Brno whose name escapes me at the moment. And the first real novel I did, I think, was Miloslava Holubova's Vits než jeden život, More Than One Life, for Northwestern University Press. And I did that because Kusi knew the author, and her son paid me to do it because Northwestern didn't pay very much. Oh, hello. Thank you. That was my start, yeah, so.
So the paths are various. For the second round, I would like to address sort of individual questions to each of our participants, sort of specific to their experience. Paul, you have translated Shvoretsky, Hrabal, Havel, Klima. We're talking the really big guns of the best-known generation of Czech writers. I'd be interested to know, with which of these writers have you had the most sort of active interaction working on the translation or on anything related to literature? And was there ever any time at which you had conflicts with the writers over matters of translation or or anything extraneous to that?
Well, obviously because Skoretsky lives in Toronto, and when I left, was asked to leave Czechoslovakia, I went back home to Toronto. I had a lot of direct contact with Skoretsky, and it was very fruitful over the years. I don't think I could have translated his work without this direct contact with him. And Skoretsky himself is a translator. Right. So he translated, I believe, Faulkner. He and Jan Zabrana collaborated on a lot of stuff. I think he also translated some Hemingway. So he was aware, as a writer, he was certainly aware of translators' problems, which really made it a joy to work with him, because if there was something, for example, a sentence that just didn't want to go into English at all, he was quite willing to revise it or suggest another way of saying it. And there were also a lot of problems that crop up, and this is a standard thing that happens in translation where there is something that makes sense to a Czech readership but doesn't make sense to an English readership without some kind of explanation. Mm-hmm. But you don't want footnotes in novels, so the Czechs have this technique, which Joseph told me about and taught me, I guess, which was the hidden footnote, which is you simply translate a little with a little more detail than was in the original text in order to make it comprehensible, so that the English reader gets a seamless impression of what the Czech reader would have got without the explanation, if you see what I mean.
Okay. So that's sort of like... And then they went to the northern Bohemian city of Liberec. So.
Well, something like that, yeah. Yeah. There's lots of things in Czech. I mean, if you use the word unor in a Czech sentence, it's loaded with all kinds of historical meaning. And the word February in English means February. It means cold. It means Valentine's Day. It means a bunch of stuff. But it certainly doesn't mean what it means to the Czechs. And a lot of the times, a lot of times in Skoretsky's work or other work of other Czech writers, this word is referenced and it's never explained, because it's assumed that the reader understands what it means or what it implies or what the freight, the baggage that word has. So I had... a full kind of almost like a lifetime of the last 30 years I've been working with Joseph, and it's been a real joy to work with him. And Havel, on the other hand, never seemed to want... Well, okay, there was a different situation. Havel was in Prague, I was in Toronto, and when I began translating, the first thing I did by him was The Power of the Powerless, which is a long essay. And I really struggled over that. That was where I kind of dealt with, how to deal with his very particular vocabulary. But then the next job that I got was to do the letters to Olga. And there were lots of problems there, because there were many, many passages which I couldn't make sense of, and there were lots of passages where he uses philosophical language from phenomenology, which was actually translated from German into Czech, and then I had to translate it back into English. and I had to go back to Heidegger's translations in English and try to figure out what, you know, the words are. It was incredibly complicated. So I compiled a list of about 300 or 400 Ozechi, you know, the sort of nuts.
Tough
questions. And I wrote a long letter to Havel asking, you know, how he would deal with these, you know, like what he actually meant. The problem was that there was no direct postage system that we could use. So my letter had to go to Gordon Skilling, who then passed it on to his contacts, who then, you know, took it to Jan Kavan or somebody, who then smuggled the letter into Czechoslovakia. It got probably through using a Shiklova to Havel, and then he would then write a reply to me, and it came back. So the exchange of a single letter took probably 3 months, maybe 4 months. And when I finally got the letter back from Havel, the letter said, "I'm sorry, Paul, I can't help you. I don't even know myself anymore what I meant, because many of the passages in these letters to Olga were written specifically to kind of bamboozle the Czech prison censors so that I could get stuff out, and it's really much too complicated. I'm sorry, you're on your own." So I had to deal to deal with these problems. I actually had to go to Europe and meet with a close associate of Havel's, Eugen Niemetz, and then I sat down with him for 3 or 4 days, and we went through these, and we kind of tried to solve these problems. But so my collaboration with Havel was very minimal. And I think that, and that has been the case ever since, because he's always been too busy. I mean, you can't ask the president of a country to sit down with you for half a day and go over problems, in the speeches that he's written or whatever. So, in the case of Ivan Klima, just very briefly, his writing is so smooth, and so, I won't say simple, but he's the most natural writer of those three writers. Hrabal is in a category by himself. but it was the cream, you know, I won't say it was easy, but it was a real pleasure just to be able to translate something that's so writerly and so clear. Hrabal was a problem unto itself. But I got the most help, not from Hrabal, with whom I was not in touch, but with Czech workers who had emigrated to Canada and who were absolute, you know, fanatical fans of Hrabal, who loved his writing. So these were butchers, these were bricklayers, people like that, who actually kind of really enjoyed Hrabal's language and who gave me a sense of what it meant in English. And so that was another a totally different kind of collaboration, but one that I think worked.
Great. So as we said, the paths are many. Rob, you are unique on our panel this evening as the only person here who has ever run a publishing house. And as I alluded to in my introductory comments, one which has done a great service to Czech literature. So I wonder if you could give us sort of the nutshell version of the history of Catbird Press, how it came about, what it was like to be running it when you were very active, and any other insights you would like to share with our audience about running a publishing house that specializes, among other things, in literature translated from Czech.
It's a long history. Basically, at the end, I haven't been publishing books for several years now. I've moved on, but the books are still available. But I started back in the mid-'80s with the goal of publishing primarily two different, I suppose three. One was a sophisticated humor. The other was Czech literature, and the third was English language literature, mostly of the humorous variety. And I happened to have published my first Czech novel in the spring of 1989. So when the Velvet Revolution came along, I had the only new book of Czech literature, and ironically, the new book of Czech literature was a book from 1967 that not only was it from 67, but it was about the perils and problems of freedom by Vladimir Parel. It was called Catapult, in both Czech and English. It was a wonderful novel, and it just got incredible reviews all over the country because they had to, you know, everybody wanted to have something. Sold almost nothing, of course. But in a certain sense, it really got, things got started very quickly. And then in 1990, which was Carl Čapek's centennial of his birth, I published three volumes of his works, War with the Newts, and the three novels, his trilogy, his philosophical trilogy, and then a something called Toward the Radical Center, which was a collection of plays and stories and essays and feuilletons by Čapek, which was edited by Peter Kusey. And that was really, you know, a really like the major small press event of the year. It was really just got incredible. In a year where the academic world completely ignored Carl Čapek, and luckily it, you know, we got enormous attention. And that was really the, in the way he phrased the question, that was sort of the heyday. That was really the height for Catbird. And I was also doing other books. And you know, as time went on, and after you got further away from the Velvet Revolution, you know, interest in Czech literature went down. It became really harder and harder. And I published some incredible works. I mean, the great thing about publishing literature in translation is that you can publish really the best literature, really, really great world literature, which is very hard to do with American writers because the big houses are all competing for them. But one of the things, just to, I suppose, give a little background, when you're publishing literature in translation, one of the reasons why you don't see a lot of it is two. One is that it costs more to publish because you have to pay a translator and an author. And two, and when you publish books, you don't, especially literature, you don't make most of your money from selling books. You make it from selling rights. Mm-hmm. And when you publish a work in translation, you don't have many rights to sell because one of the main rights is foreign language rights. So you don't have that because you don't have the original rights to the original. You don't have film rights. You might have paperback rights, but it's almost impossible to sell paperback rights in foreign literature unless, you know, something amazing. And those are all the areas you make money in. So it's really very, very hard to even break even on literature and translations. You have the wonderful side is you can publish great works and you get to work with wonderful translators. One of the things I learned when I was doing my book on literary translation, I went around and interviewed translators all over the country and as well as in Europe. And there is no other group of artists, I think, in any art that are more intelligent and interesting and completely open to being interviewed because nobody ever interviews them.
That's right.
And I could walk into anywhere, and it was just wonderful. I mean,
do you want to say you could get a whole panel of them to say sit down in a room in New York? It just like that.
Well, no, I mean, actually, 1 year, Penn now has, you know, the Penn American Center, the writers organization, now has this incredible thing, which is going on, which just yesterday was the last day, that called, what is it? It's the world, you know, they bring in writers from all over the world. But just before.
World Voices.
World Voices, that's right. And just before that, I was on the Penn Translation Committee. It was actually, they didn't have much money. So it was a very small thing, but it was actually all over the country. And I arranged to have translators do readings in bookstores all over the country. I was in charge of it 1 year, many years ago. And the focus was actually not on the authors, but on the translators and trying to get people to understand what translators' role is in literature. So it's very easy. I mean, just call up and they like, I can go do a reading in a bookstore. It's like, you know, it's great. So it's a wonderful world of, you know, it's great working with translators and really appreciating what they did, which is why I did the book, you know, to really bring that to some audience, at least a little small audience. But it's a really hard, the business has changed completely several years ago. I mean, I suppose I realized that things were coming to him when I published Alex Zucker's translation of City, Sister, Silver, and got a full-page review in the New York Times Book Review, a large arts, one of the daily arts pages on the author, and also wonderful reviews all over. And I couldn't get books into stores in New York or anywhere else, practically. I have distribution and everything. It's so hard to break through. It became all about money, and it's very hard. So at least in terms of actually selling books, not to mention rights and all those other things, it's hard. And I wasn't subsidized. I didn't get any, except for that book, but most of that went else. There was a, got a grant from the Czech government. They were very good. And it was in the very, very beginning they started giving out grants. I think you might have gotten the first one.
I don't know so, about that.
It was hard to turn down that book because it was the great book of the 90s, so great novel of the 90s. So, but that's the nutshell story. There's a lot more, but move on to Alex and your question for Alex.
Well, yeah, the one bit I should have mentioned in introductions, I didn't want to read a whole lot of introductions, but just wanted to mention, this is a, since we're speaking about translation, this is the National Translation Award book for 2010, so please recognize Alex for the award. The question I have for Alex pertains to these books on the table here.
Which will be for sale afterwards. Heavily discounted. There's only 5 copies of 3 of them and 4 of 1, but I wanted to make sure they were available.
Thank you. I was realizing I was... I teach every 2 years a survey of post-war Czech literature. It's the successor course to a course I took with Peter Kusy once upon a time. I've tried to bring the syllabus into the 21st century to include works written since 89. And I've realized that all the information, the whole impression that the English-speaking world can get about what's been happening in Czech literature and what is going to continue happening in Czech literature depends an awful lot on what Czech books get translated by Alex and the handful of other translators who translate younger and middle-aged Czech authors into English. So I was curious to hear Alex speak about how he decides what books he's going to translate, whether the choice is his own or whether it's a publishing house's choice or some other entity that is deciding what works of contemporary Czech literature make it into English.
Yeah. Well, I think there was an earlier version of this panel where it was being billed as translators talking about their amusing escapades translating literature, and I was like, this is not an amusing question, but but it is very interesting, and I told Chris I was really glad that he asked it because this is the, this seamy underbelly of the literary publishing world and literary translation, which is that economics, of the books of the 4 books that are here, and there's one other one I translated, which was the one I mentioned before, which was by Miloslava Holubova. One of them I personally sold, and the other ones were initiated by other people. Books are hard to... Literary translations are supposedly hard to sell. I don't know how far to go into this, but there are a lot of prejudices on the part of publishers about works that are translated from other languages. But I think that, I will say that as a translator, I do feel a responsibility about... I see translating as a service. I see it as a service to the author first, to the reader, because I'm making something available to readers that wouldn't be available otherwise, and I guess maybe to literature, but I think of it more in terms of readers and authors. Because personally, given the amount of time it takes to translate a book, I would rather not translate a book that I don't absolutely love. But I have translated books that I don't love. I mentioned one of them earlier. But that wasn't, for publication. But but the fact is that, you can go back down the chain. I can't make the decision to translate something unless I know Czech, and I can't know Czech unless there's a place to study Czech. So, how far back do you want to go on the chain of responsibility? And the Czech Republic... I think, does a decent job of supporting Czech literature and translation. I think right now there are about two or three books a year that come out in English translated from Czech, and I think those books are supported all in some way financially by the Czech Ministry of Culture. If nobody knows Czech, then nobody can translate. And the way that people learn languages when they're coming from small countries like the Czech Republic, which is 10 million people, is there has to be somebody teaching Czech. And those positions have to be funded. And I think, you know, and then we're getting into an area which I don't know, which is teaching of foreign languages. But I suspect that, like publishing of foreign works in translation, those positions, you know, the longer lasting ones are ones that have been subsidized by the countries. So, you know, if you went back down the chain, you could say how many books are translated from Czech into English depends on what sort of commitment the Czech government and Czech Republic wants to make to people learning Czech who can translate the books into English. I mean, so having said that, I would say that so Sestra, or as we called it in English City, Sister Silver, was a book that I read. And, well, actually, I have to say, I committed to translating it even before I had read it because I knew the author. I had translated a long short story of his called A Trip to the Train Station, which actually has just been reissued in a Czech-English bilingual version in Prague. And
in Arabic.
And in Arabic. That's another story. But and I'd done some of his poems, and I was very good friends with him, and I just knew that I wanted to do it, and I had no idea what I was getting myself into. But then with All This Belongs to Me, again, I knew the author, Petra Hulova, and I read the book, and I liked it, but I did not actually make the sale because she, as well as Joachim Topol, and actually this author as well, all happened to have an agent. And who handles their foreign rights. And actually, no, he's not Joachim's agent. I take that back. And so this man, his name is Edgar de Bruin, and he is a translator into Dutch from Czech, and he also serves as agent for a number of Czech authors. And he sold the rights for that book as he did for the Ořeník. So the Hulova is published by Northwestern University Press. These two Ořeník novels are published by Dalky Archive. And those were all, the Hulova was kind of, Edgar told me he was offering the book to Northwestern, asked me if I was interested. I said, definitely, for sure. And then these other two, I was basically offered the job. So I did not choose them. And really the first time I took translations, not because I was in love with the book, but because I wanted to work and I thought it would be good translation job to do, because I like Dalky Archive Press a lot, though. I really believe in them as a publishing house, and they're one of the few publishing houses in this country that's committed to literature and translation in a long-term way. So I would say another thing I think is interesting, if you look at the books that Paul has translated, these authors were mostly published by, you know, big publishing houses, Harcourt Brace and Knopf and Farrar, Straus, Giroux. Or no.
Probably.
Yeah. And these books.
Faber and Faber,
you know, I mean, yeah. Big guns, you know. Yeah, so
there were always sort of three-country publications. There was, you know, Canada, U.S., and Great Britain all at
right.
the same time. So there were, like, international publications.
Right. So, you know, very different. I mean, my impression is that there's actually maybe more opportunity to get translations published, but maybe for less money or less publicity because mm-hmm. there are more publishing houses. I mean, I think literary translation is exploded in the last 10 years as far as how much coverage it gets, and a lot of it has to do with websites and so on. Mm-hmm. But so I'll leave it at that.
Okay, my last question, or sort of another dual question, just a sort of a quick one, is if you could each say which translation that you've done you feel most proud of, and also if you have... and why? And also, if you have a favorite translation of one of your colleagues, either someone here or someone not here, a work of translation from Czech to English that you've always really admired.
Oh, that's a hard question. I've enjoyed doing almost every single translation that I've done. I've really had I wouldn't say fun all the time, but it was always an interesting challenge. For example, The Engineer of Human Souls has a particular set of challenges in that it covers three regimes, the Nazi regime and the communist regime, and then the experience of the author slash main character in Canada. And so there were all kinds of different levels of language that had to be dealt with. It was a book that consisted of the narrator telling the story, and then there were letters that were all written in different voices, and so it was a tremendous challenge, but it was really a lot of fun, actually, doing that. So I enjoyed that. What else? I mean, I really enjoyed translating Havel's plays, and he's the only playwright that I've ever translated into English, although I'm thinking that there might be some other playwrights that I might try to tackle. But translating plays is a particular pleasure, because at a certain stage, I do a first draft, or I work with my wife Patricia, who's an actor, I should say, and we then take it to the cast, or a cast, or a bunch of actors who then read the play, or sometimes perform the play. But in the process of rehearsal, we can make adjustments to the actual translation, and that's fun as well. My favorite translation, I think, of Skvoretsky's is Scherzo. It was called in Czech Scherzo Capriccioso. In English, we called it Dvořák in Love. And that was a novel that went through sort of a double transformation. I translated the original text into English. It's a series of related chapters narrated by different characters that jumps all over the place chronologically. So the first chapter starts with Dvořák being recruited to come to America in 1892 or in 1893. And the second chapter begins after his death. And the book jumps back and forth. And I have had the great privilege of working with a brilliant editor, Louise Dennis, in Toronto, who's the head of Knopf Canada now. She came up she reshuffled the deck, essentially. And we sat down with Skvoretsky and we said we want to change the order of the chapters around. And what happened was that book was transformed. I translated it from Czech to English, but then she transformed it from a Czech novel into an American novel simply by translating, by moving the chapters around. So that the book ends in the 1930s, and the English book ends in the 1930s, and it's really when you read it, it's a book about the kind of the way in which Black American culture and European culture sort of came together, so that Dvořák then becomes the kind of an example of someone who inspires early Black Broadway musicals, who inspires Duke Ellington, and who is kind of like a progenitor of modern jazz, if you like. It's an amazing book. That doesn't come across when you read it in Czech, because the emphasis is different, right? So it's a fascinating book, and I wish that somebody like Milos Forman would make a great movie out of it, because it would tell you it's a book that covers a forgotten aspect of American history, which is what happened to that generation of talented people whose parents were born in slavery, and who had enormous cultural ambitions for their children, and who managed to get them sent to these great conservatories in New York, and then who became part of the kind of mainstream of American popular culture, if you like. So anyway, that was a lot of fun. And translations of other Czech books. I'm going to talk about just briefly about the fate of The Good Soldier Shveik in English, because there have been several attempts to translate it into English, and they're all very interesting. There's three translations, two that are available in print. One of them by a translator called Paul Selver, who translated the the uncompleted novel in the 1930s, I believe, and who cut a lot of it out. I mean, he just simply left a whole bunch of stuff out, and he didn't deal with the vulgarities very well. The second translation came out in the 1970s, and it was by a former British ambassador to Prague called
Cecil Parrot.
I was going to say it was a bird. I thought it might have been partridge, but no, it's parrot. Okay, right. Sir Cecil Parrot, who translated the whole book, whose translation is absolutely, I would say, very diligent. But the book itself was written in conditions that, and this is something that you know, we can talk about a little more. Translators and writers have, you know, work in very different ways. Hašek wrote that book in a bar. He wrote that book, you know, he ordered himself a beer, he sat down, he wrote a chapter, he sent it off to the printer. It came out as a serialized novel that he never finished. And so when you have a translator with a scholarly bent translating that book, you get a very exact translation, but there's something missing in the kind of spirit in which it was written, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So I still think that the definitive translation of Schrake has yet to be done. And I fantasize about an old age spent in a bar somewhere in Ireland.
Okay.
Translating this thing, you know, into some, I mean, I think the Irish history and the Irish sense of humor and Irish sort of, you know, slang is something that might actually work. I'm just fantasizing now. But that's a project yet to be done.
Okay.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be me who does it, but you heard it here first.
There's one more new translator, at least one more, right?
I don't know of the first
There's
part,
another
right?
one. That's right.
Right.
But I don't know who did it.
It's
I don't remember.
Couple. Yeah, they sent it to me, actually, and I just didn't think it was very good. But I think they self-published it or found
two
someone
people.
That published it.
Yeah. Two
it
people.
But
I forget,
and
it was years ago.
It was an attempt to do the kind of thing you're talking about, to, you know, loosen it up a little bit.
Up,
it's a little bit less liberal, you know, less literal, and making an attempt to find an equivalent idiom. I think for me, knowing the Czech text in the back of my mind, I wasn't satisfied with it because I felt that that's not what it was. You know, but
that's the whole thing. I mean, that is a really, really, really difficult. Hašek is incredibly hard to translate.
Oh, yeah.
And yet when you read it in Czech, it reads very easily and it's funny and so on. But you sit down and you try to, even his short stories, you know, because he just dashed them off. You know, I mean, and you can't dash a translation off in the same way. You just can't do it.
So do you have a favorite translation of your own and a favorite translation of someone else's?
Well, my own, I'll do it quickly. I only translated one book, but the one I'm most proud of was my first published translation. It was amazing. Before I went off on my own, I was the editor at Princeton Architectural Press, an architectural publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a history that we published by a Princeton professor who, it was a brilliant history, but it was a bunch of essays about 18th century writers in which who had dealt with architectural themes. Mm. And some of them were architects, some of them were actually just writers with no architectural background. And it was this brilliant essay, but it was all these quotes from all these French writers. And the problem is that, two problems. One is that he couldn't translate. He just had no idea what to do with translation. And two, he didn't have the original text. So as an editor, I had to retranslate all of his translations without the original text.
Wow.
And throughout the whole book, I mean, it wasn't like I could look up a couple. It was you know, over 100 translations and pieces of things. And I was very proud. I mean, I think they're wonderful translations. I have no idea if they're accurate, but they're really good translations.
That's a great achievement.
That was my first. That's how I started. So I did know French. I'm actually, one of the funniest things is we once got a blurb, actually, for Karl Čapek. From Milan Kundera, but he didn't have what he had written in French. So a Czech writer, he wrote the blurb in French. It was published by a German publisher of Čapek. And so Peter Cusey and I, the Czech translator, translated it back from Czech
into, I mean, from German into what we thought the French originally was, and then into English. So again, we were translating, and we were missing the French translation. So sometimes some of those fun translations are ones where you're actually missing the text. But that was very short, luckily. In terms of I mean, it's really hard. I absolutely love his translation of Dvorak and Love. So, but he's already said that. And by the way, Peter Cusey in the did publish a bunch of stories of Hašek a long time ago. And there is one thing that's sort of interesting. If anybody wants to read a nice, I'm trying to remember the name of it, but there's a very nice story by Karl Čapek about, it doesn't say his name, but it's about Hašek sitting in a bar and writing. And I forget, I think that's the one about the parrot, actually, isn't it? Yeah, it's the one. It's something about the parrot. I don't have
it here.
The
dead parrot? Not the dead parrot.
No, no. It's this bet and stuff. It's very funny. Anyway, it has the word parrot in it, but it's not as long before Parrot the translator came along. But these things do come together.
Or the Monty Python.
But I was going to mention Peter Cusey, even if he was here, his translation of Karl Palachek's book, which we called "What Ownership's All About." And it's the first and only time he's appeared in English in a book-length manuscript. And he's one of those authors that, unlike, you know, Joachim Topol, who you look at and you say, oh, my God, how are you ever going to translate this? You know, people always told me, you know, you've got to publish him, but he's untranslatable. I sort of two different people. Usually one person would say, you have to translate Palachek. And other people would say, but you can't translate. You can't do it. And I thought Peter did an amazing job. One thing that's interesting about difficulty in translation is it comes in lots of different forms. It can come in something that's extremely complex. It can come in something like Jaroslav Seifert's poetry, which is extremely simple and extremely difficult to translate. And I also published a volume of that by Ewald Ozers. And there's been a lot of translation. He's another author that nobody's ever, you know, that there's been a lot of unsatisfactory translations of. Yes. It's very simple and very hard. Palachek's different. I mean, it's not that complex, but yet it's very, very hard to bring across. And I thought Peter did an amazing job. And it's the thing he's least known for. You know, Kundera is 10 times easier than Palachek. Yes. So.
Just one other thing I wanted to say about going back to your question from before, Chris, was that the other thing about having the web is now there are other ways that people can read Czech literature, you know, and so I've done shorter things for websites.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, I just did a story by Magdalena Placová, who's here tonight, for this online journal called Two Lines, which the Center for the Art of Translation puts out. And so there are other ways now. You don't have to translate a book to but anyway. I won the American Literary Translators Association gave me this incredible national translation award for the Hulova, All This Belongs to Me. So that's great. But I will say definitely my favorite translation will probably always be City Sister Silver because, partly because of how long I spent with it. And
me too.
Yeah, and Rob was with me through all, I think we went two drafts. We could have used a third, but it was, you know, 250,000 words. And to give you an idea, so this book is 80,000, and these are about 30,000. So it's long. And also because, you know, it's the kind of book that I think somebody should do at the end of their career, not at the beginning. And there was a woman actually at the ALTA conference who was talking about somebody saying, you know, I think it was like a really great, I mean, knowing, like, I didn't really know any other translators for a long time. And I think if I had known more, I would have been more intimidated by the book, you know, because I somehow, you know, now I've been spending all this time around translators and I hear them saying what they do and what they learned, and somehow I figured all that stuff out on my own. So I think that if you're my experience was as a reader, somebody who spent his whole life reading, that I somehow managed to realize these things that, you know, I don't know, like the internal footnotes. I mean, what else are you going to do? Or how do you come up with these creative solutions? But it was also early days of the World Wide Web, so some of the tools, I mean, there are things I look up now that I couldn't look up then. One of the key things about City Sister Silver was there were a lot of references, not just references to the Bible, but there were words that were from the Bible. So how do you find out whether a word is from the Bible or not? Well, you have to look in a Czech Bible. Well, how long are you going to look through a Czech Bible to find one effing word, right? So fortunately, and which version of the Czech Bible, right? So fortunately, and I knew if he was using from the Czech Bible, it had to be from the Kralická Bible, which is the Bible in Czech. So fortunately, some crazy guy had a searchable version of the Kralická Bible online. Great. And I almost wanted to thank that guy in the acknowledgments of the book. I didn't in the end, but I did write him an email and thank him personally. And there was that whole section which I thought was I was surprised more people didn't write about in the reviews, because I thought was maybe the most familiar part of the book for an American audience was the chapter with a whole chapter called "I Had a Dream," which is set in Auschwitz in the concentration camp, and you have this Czech everyman, Josef Novák, who's taking the characters on this tour of the camp and describing all the terrible things that happened there. But he's a very, very, almost Schwäkisch, I would say.
Oh, yes.
That was who I thought of was Schwäk. Folksy guy, right? And using all of this World War II era slang. So I couldn't use any slang that or words that this guy was using that were after I decided 1945. So I don't know if Joachim Topol, I don't know how rigorous he was, but I, you know, these are the things that I consider necessary. So I found the Random House had this historical dictionary of American slang, but they only got through two volumes before the project collapsed for lack of money, so it only went up to O, you know? No. I mean, they never, to this day, they haven't put out the third volume, you know? So it was stuff like that, you know? And that was a lot of fun. And I also felt a very personal connection to the novel, probably because we were close in age and probably because part of it was about, you know, these first years after the end of communism, which is when I lived in Prague from 90 to 95. And I just, you know, I don't think I'll ever identify with a book again as closely as I identified with that one. And this other part I really catches, I don't know what my favorite translation by somebody else. I mean, but I will, but this is what comes to mind. And I'm not just saying it because you're here, Paul, but "I Serve the King of England" was a book that was really important to me because it's the only book that I ever sat down and I read it side by side, your translation in the Czech.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I think
it was okay.
Yeah. And I think, I think the first time I actually met you in person, I grilled you about it. We were at a pub in Prague because in the version of the Czech that I read, although there were like 18 different versions of Hrabal because of all the official censorship and different versions in Samizdat, the first sentence of every chapter was always, you know, "A teď vám teda řeknu," you know, or something like this. "And now I'm gonna tell you." Right. And you didn't have that. And I remember asking you, like, "Why did you leave that?" I didn't say it like that, but
what was my answer? I can't.
Well, probably because it wasn't in the version.
I don't think
it
was in the version that you had. "A teď vám teda povím," I think it was actually, you know, which I thought made it clear that he was sitting there in the pub talking to people, you know, and that wasn't in it.
Yeah.
But. And recently saw somebody, and again on some blog that's out, the zillion blogs now about literary translation, talking. Oh, it was I think it was Susan Bernofsky talking about going through a Robert Walser book that she really liked before she was a translator, and she was just learning German and translating it from German, and so I think this maybe is an important experience for a literary translator to have, is to take time, go through a whole book and say, this is what it says in Czech, and this is what this person did with it. And you learn a lot that way, you know. And I'll never do it again. But it was fantastic, you know. So I would say because of the time that I put into it, that would be my favorite.
Okay. I'd like to thank the panel for answering my questions, and I would like to turn the floor over to our audience. And I believe there's a microphone somewhere that we can pass. I saw Irena's hand go up first, so I'd like to give her the first question. And a second question here.
It's really funny because that what you ended your talk is exactly the question I had. You spoke about, like, you asked them about their favorite author, like a favorite translation from Czech to English. But when I know the original language, I rarely go to read the translation. You know, I read the book in if it's published in English, I read it in English. If it's published in Czech, I read it in Czech. So how often do you actually read Czech books in English? Yeah?
Me? Rarely. I mean, I rarely read Czech books in Czech. Somebody was saying, the ones I read are the ones I translate. I don't know. It's been a while since I read a Czech book in English. It's frustrating because I don't get to read it. I'm always reading through it to what it might have said in Czech.
Yeah, that's exactly my experience when I read
no fun.
Kundera books that were not published in Czech yet. Right. And then I had to read them in English. I think it was the Book of Laughter and Forgetting. And I mean, just I always feel like I'm searching for what it was in the original. And that's, I guess, why I don't read in translation.
Yeah, it really depends. I mean, there's one case of a German novel that I published where even the author said that it's better in English than in Czech. Wow. I mean, in German. I mean, it really depends on, there's some writers where you can, like Vladimir Parl, you can capture 100% in English. It just translates in English so easily because he wrote run-on sentences that don't use the form of Czech sentences, and he used fairly straightforward language, a lot of repetition in a non-Kunderian manner, that is, that you could actually keep most of the repetition and not get into that whole argument, which I won't get into. So there really it depends. There's an argument that actually Kundera, some of Kundera's is better than his. I mean, he's not one of the sentence by sentence is not one of the better Czech writers, as far as I'm concerned. But he has his skills are in elsewhere than in his words. But it really varies greatly in terms of the difference between whether there's usually there's a loss, but a good translator can make up for it in a lot of other ways. And if you have the two texts, often people get very upset because there's just not there. But often there's some things you can't do, like puns. But if somebody puns a lot, then you can pun a lot, but not necessarily in the same place. Right. And so sometimes it'll look like, or somebody, if it's not their first language, won't actually get the fact that there are puns elsewhere because they might not catch them. They might not understand the humor. So it's hard. It's hard, but good translations are really great things, but it's hard. It's really hard to read it. Nobody's ever taught how to read a translation.
They're teaching them now in these MFA programs.
We're now learning.
Okay, yeah. The microphone has been passed. I'm sorry.
By the way, those cases are known as it loses something in the original.
Ah, right? Yes.
Right. And there are many of those. What I've been sort of fooling around with lately in translation, the whole issue of humor, which is what Paul pointed out, which in some ways is probably the most difficult thing to translate. Mm-hmm. Translation is a serious business, right? And serious literature is a serious business. I've recently been looking at the new translation of The Brothers Karamazov, which in the Volkhonsky is really very funny. The same with Kafka. These are serious writers. We need serious translators. Mm-hmm. But we don't know how to translate humor. And this is, I think, one of the major problems in translation.
Well, it's getting better. I mean, a lot of the writers like Mann, as you say, Mann and Kafka, the translators are doing, the newer translators have done a much better job.
Yeah. Right. But, for example, I was at a conference at Goethe House some years back, and the writers were there and the translators were there. And the writers were reading very funny things. And the translators were reading very serious things. and this is, I think, a real problem. We don't know how to read. And we don't know how to read to translate. And we don't know how to read translations either. So
these two books right here are both very funny.
They are.
Okay, I would just like to start with a little bit of a historical anecdote. If this were to be like in the 19th century, if when Pilecki and Kolar apocryphally were trapped in the farmhouse in Moravia, and supposedly Pilecki said to Kolar, sometime in the early 19th century, if the wall falls down in this farmhouse, the Czech National Renaissance is over. If the wall falls down here, Czech literature and English is in serious trouble. But the question I'd like to ask brings something that Alex brought up again near the end. But I'd like to ask the entire panel how the web is changing the way in which both the production of translations, both in the sort of minutiae of translating documents from one language into another, and in the larger sense of translating works of literature from one language into another, but also the marketing and the selling, and how the web is affecting the market for translations, particularly from less commonly spoken languages.
Well, I mean, I really can't answer that because I use the web for research.
Yeah.
Because I can't, because I don't have, we have dial-up where I live. That's right. I honestly don't know. I mean, I've never actually, because I live in a webless world, more or less, you know, I don't think about this. But it is a tremendous resource in doing research that wasn't there before. But I have no idea, you know, what potential it would have apart from the obvious potential of you know, promoting and selling and distributing stuff in a different way. I'm leery about putting anything on the web where I would be that hasn't passed through the editorial process. I think that having an editor to work with is a real bonus for everybody, writers and translators. I would be nervous about putting out. I mean, I would consider like a first draft. Something that hadn't actually been passed through another eye, because part of the problem in translation is getting the text really into English. You know, the first draft is always kind of halfway there.
Getting it out of the original
language.
Getting
out of the original. And when I read, let's say, even a second or third draft of my own translations, I'm still, you know, seeing it through the eyes of the original, if you've pardon the expression. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like the original is always somehow there. So if there's something that doesn't make sense to a purely English reader, I'm not going to catch it. And that's why I think an editor or a third eye or a second eye is really important. And the web doesn't provide those second or third eyes. So
you know the web better than
anyone. Well, I'm just going to be really brief because there's so many questions, but the sites that I was talking about, I'm thinking of Words Without Borders and I think Transitions Online. Not Transitions. What's that one that Alexandra Bichler does? Maybe it's Transition. There are others out there. Calc, maybe that's not. What? Transcript, right. Not Transitions. Thank you, Transcript. Two Lines. They do have editors, so...
Right.
The translation venues or outlets or whatever you would call them online that I'm thinking of, they are like publishing houses, only they don't print anything.
Right.
I'm just going to leave it there because there are other questions. So.
One other thing I'll just throw in is that I think the e-book phenomenon is a good thing because it is very hard to get literary translations other than the sort of the major authors into bookstores, and ebook can be there for anyone who at least has an ebook reader or wants to read on the computer, and it keeps things available. And so I think that's a good thing for foreign literature. Not big numbers, but at least it's available and it remains available. And you also can charge less because you don't have all that paper.
I will say, I know like there's this whole thing and there's this website and publishing house 3% and Open Letter out of University of Rochester, Chad Post, which is great. But I think I changed my opinion about, you know, we have a fewer percentage of our of books in this country are translation than in probably any other country in the world.
Right.
But I don't think right now that we're suffering from a lack of translations. There is no way, I mean, from any given country, maybe, but there's no way I could possibly keep up with all the works in translation. So yeah. I think there's more available now than there used to be.
Yeah, there's more available, but from smaller presses. That's really what you sort of said before.
Okay, I guess Susanna has taken over the transmission of the microphone, so try to get her attention if you have the question.
I would like to ask something. I've been thinking about translation for a long time, living between two languages, and what I'm really interested in is if it has been written that each translation creates a new text, and I'm very interested in the role of the translator. How does it complicate the idea of authorship? You know, if you're actually rewriting somebody's work, what part of you do you leave within that text? That's what's really interesting to me. If I give each of you the same text, I would come back with four different translations, right? Four different texts. So I'm interested in the idea of the author, and the process of translation is actually a process of writing. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I had a funny experience once when I had just finished translating, I think, or was in the process of translating. No, I'd finished the translation of Letters to Olga, and I was writing an introduction to the book. And it was a hard thing to do because the introduction was meant to introduce Havel more or less for the first time to, what we hoped would be a wider English-speaking audience. And so I had to say a lot about, you know, he was in prison. I had to say a lot about who he was and so on. So it was a very hard thing to write, and I worked on it for a couple of months, actually. And one night I was very tired, and it was late, and I was going through this thing that I'd written, and I suddenly said to myself, there's something wrong with that sentence. I wonder what the original was. And then I kind of caught myself. And I said, wait a minute, you know, what just happened here, right? And I suddenly, you know, came to the conclusion at that point that writing was actually a form of translating, and what you were translating was your own thoughts into available and accessible English. And shortly after that, I came across a great line by E.B. White, who was writing a letter to a very anxious young woman who'd written him to ask him something about the writing life. And he said, and I'm quoting it very, not exactly, but I'm paraphrasing it, he said, all writing is essentially translating, and the thing that you are translating is yourself. Hmm. And I thought that was right. But the thing is that you can't think that way when you're translating somebody else. And so the business of translating someone else, you really have to put your ego on the shelf and just, you know, do your best to make sure that you have said what he or she has said in the original in your own language.
Yeah, I would add that I think, you know, what's one of the things you learn from translation is that what's important about what, you know, about art isn't necessarily what a lot of people think. You know, the story of the writer, the writer's relationship with the father, and all those things. Those all go into making literature. But there's so many other things that go into making literature. And those things are still there in translation. They're not, it's not your biography as much as it is your skills, the way you use language, the ability you have to get into a character and create a voice for the characters, just like a writer does. So there's a lot of skills that go into writing that are separate from the actual story of the writer or necessarily even the experiences of the writer, though your experiences, if you haven't had an experience, there may be things that you don't really understand. But so it just shed light on what it means to be an artist, I think, separating in a way that, you know, in literature, you don't. I mean, it's true. We accept that of an actor, but we don't really accept that. That's also true of a translator.
I don't know how to answer the question, so I'll pass.
I was a teenager when Ventura's Margarita Lazarova was published. It made a very great impression at the time. I wonder whether it was ever translated.
Ah. I applied in December for a grant from the National Endowment of the Arts to translate that book.
Wow.
I will find out in September or October if I got the grant, and if I got the grant, I will translate it.
I think there was an excerpt from that that was once in an anthology. It's in the. Do you have the? There's a wonderful. I don't know if it's been updated, but there's a wonderful Library of Congress bibliography of Czech literature and translation. But I'll send it to you.
It hasn't been done yet. There are two other books of Von Čura's in English though, and one of them just came out recently. It was called. It's one of his funnier ones.
Capricious Summer.
Thank you.
Summer, yeah. Yeah, I think the title in English was Summer of Caprice, Rosmarne Lato.
Translated into English and published in Prague, and I think it's good.
Do you remember how the first sentence was translated?
I don't remember how the first sentence.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I don't remember how he translated that, yeah.
So I have a question sort of in the same vein, asking about a work and if it's been translated. I've brought what may be my favorite book, which is called Pražský chodec. I say that it might be my favorite book because I can't read it. I can't read Czech. But I know this is a wonderful book, and I'm wondering if anyone has translated it. I can't find...
Pražský chodec.
I have the sense that some... Nezval. I have the sense that someone did. I thought I saw it in a Prague bookstore in English. I could be wrong.
Well, I just had a question that seems natural from the kinds of questions that were just asked before, which is there a book of Czech literary, a Czech literary work from any time in history that has not yet been translated that needs to be translated?
I already answered.
And we have the Schweig needs a better translation, but somebody... for the others, is there something that you would want to have translated that maybe you don't want to do yourself, but you think would be important to have translated?
Oh yeah.
Well, you know, I'm kind of fond of Pavel Eisner's Chrám i tvrz.
That's what I was going to say. That's my choice.
But but think about it. It's all about the Czech language.
I know.
So this is like setting yourself an impossible task, mm-hmm. right? It's such a well-written book. It's such an amazing compendium of all things Czech, and I'm not just talking about language. That it really deserves as a model for writing about culture. It's an amazing thing, but I don't know how you go about it. I really don't.
Here you go, and this one may be in the works. The one thing I'd really like to have a usable translation of, there's an ancient translation of, but is Erkazet, because I teach a Czech culture course, and there's probably no more important document for the national revival of the 19th century than these manuscripts, and there is a very old translation of it that doesn't quite... You know, that they rhymed it and put it into these. So I think David Cooper may be trying to produce a translation of that into modern English. So I would be grateful for that.
Okay. I think we put your hands together to this wonderful panel. Yes. Thank you for coming and join us at the bar.